welcome to the Arthroscopy Journal podcast. Brian Lau from Duke University. And today I have the privilege of speaking with Dr. Brendan Erickson from Rothman, New York. He's an assistant professor at NYU, one of the assistant team doctors for the Philadelphia Phillies, as well as a member of the Major League Baseball Research Committee. And we're going to be talking today about his paper published in Arthroscopy on the elbow ulnar collateral ligament tears, a modified consensus statement. And so, Brendan, thanks for joining us. And how's everything going in Philly?
Oh, good, man. You know, I'll tell you, Brian, I appreciate you guys having me on. Yeah, I try to do the couple games down in Philly a year, and then I always cover the Phillies and they come up here to New York, so I don't have to travel too much, which is not too bad. So, you know, started with Rothman up here a couple years ago when they opened up in New York, and been doing a good amount of, work on the UCL and trying to figure out exactly what we should do for some of these tears. And so hopefully this paper will give some answers. Probably didn't answer every question that's out there, but hopefully gave some answers to some of the questions surrounding UCL tears.
Yeah, obviously UCL is getting a lot of press with baseball, and there's a lot of misconceptions with it, you know, amongst the general public and with players and coaches. And so I think the more we can understand about it and the more we can disseminate accurate information, the better. So I think the first question is kind of, you know, it's a unique kind of setup that you guys did for this paper in terms of the modified consensus statement. And just maybe just speak a little bit of how that was formed, how the group was formed, and kind of the process a little bit, just so we have a little understanding of the methods of how this process took.
Yeah, so I'll tell you, a lot of this work, Owen Hurley, who's actually with you now as a resident, did while he was a research assistant at NYU. And they had started doing this modified Delphi statement for patellofemoral issues and for some shoulder instability. And so I was part of that work group that did it. And I was pretty excited about trying this for UCL tears, since, again, it's one of those black box things where you don't have all the answers for. So what we did was we came up with a group of 26 surgeons and rehabilitation, either therapists or docs that work in the rehab sector. And we formed these four kind of groups, our four working groups. So we had a group that was tasked with the non-operative treatment of UCL tears, one that was tasked with the operative treatment, one that was tasked with rehab and return to sport, and one that was tasked with just diagnosis in general. And so we divided the 26 members up in those groups. Obviously, all the rehabilitation people were involved in the rehabilitation section. The other surgeons were all sports or shoulder and elbow trained, either from the United States. And we had some of our international colleagues, including some of our colleagues, Dr. Sugaya from Japan, was involved in this as well. And we did what was we set up a group of questions for each group. And then the people that were involved in each working group went through and answered those questions. And then we did several rounds of questions to get down to specific statements that were then either agreed upon or not agreed upon by the members of the entire working group. And so when you see in the paper, we have the, you know, percent agreement, that's with everybody within the working group, all 26 people kind of weighing in on that.
Yeah. So it seems like basically had the working groups kind of do an initial kind of breakdown of different questions, but everyone, the whole committee kind of had final say on the final consensus. Is that right?
On the statements, yeah. So the statements got developed by the working groups based on some questions that were asked everybody. And then the entire group of 26 people gave the, you know, kind of consensus answers to those statements.
Yes. And then was this done kind of like an in-person meeting or Zoom? And how many iterations of these questions at times did you go through it?
A lot of red cap surveys, my friend. None of this was really done in person. We had some email chains that went around, and then we had a lot of red cap surveys so that all the answers to everything could be anonymous. So the entire thing was anonymous for everybody. And it just depended on how many times we had to break down each question to get consensus amongst the group before we posed the statement to the entire group. So it was somewhere between sometimes 3 to 4 rounds of it, just adding and subtracting based on what the working group thought was appropriate.
Yeah. I think it's always that balance of having discussion, but also keeping things anonymous. So I think you guys did it. This technique is really, really good. And obviously Owen, you know, who's here has been a real pioneer in this and, you know, trying to push this for some of the other different things as well. So I thought maybe we'd go through the paper kind of the way you guys did in the working groups and just kind of talk about each of the four different topics a little bit. And kind of start off with, like, you know, we'll start with diagnosis and maybe start off with, maybe you can comment on a few things that you thought kind of stood out, and then we can go from there.
Yeah, I think, you know, there were only a few kind of statements in our working group that had unanimous consensus, meaning everybody agreed upon. And a lot of the statements were in the 90% range, but there were a couple in the diagnosis group that hit 100%. Just looking at, you know, patient history factors that you should ask about, kind of looking at injury mechanism, acute versus chronic, previous elbow injuries, things like that, and kind of lists out a couple things the working group and everybody involved thought was very important. So I would say it's a good take-home point from when you're thinking about trying to make a diagnosis here about questions you should be asking to your player. And then if you look at, you know, as far as advanced imaging was concerned, everybody agreed, again, 100% consensus, saying that we should be obtaining advanced imaging, usually an MRI or an MR arthrogram, although we didn't necessarily specify within the group which of those you should obtain. Because there's, you know, there are some people that would say you can see everything on an MRI, and that probably has to do with the how good of a scanner you have, whereas some people still like to get arthrograms for this. And I don't think that's a wrong answer, depending on what scanner capabilities you have at your institution or at your surrounding areas where you get your MRIs done.
Right. And I think the key thing that I kind of took out of it was a real consensus on the physical exam things you should be looking at, kind of your classic exam finds. I didn't think there was anything too special. I think a couple of things that stood out was, you know, the stress radiographs. You know, there was some consensus for it, but then a second question there said maybe shouldn't. What's your take on it? Should we be doing stress radiographs, or what's the role in using that in the, you know, diagnosis phase?
So yeah, Brian, great question about the stress ultrasound and stress radiograph. So what I would tell you is, in my opinion, if we have pre-injury data on these players, I think the stress radiographs and stress ultrasounds are really, really useful. Just as a one-time point measurement, they can be helpful, but not quite as significant. So if you look at some of the work done by Mike Sicati and the group from Philly a couple of years back, they produced some normative data on what the amount of gapping on the inside of the elbow should be with these stress radiographs and stress ultrasound, usually using a Telos machine through a stress ultrasound with one of the radiologists. And they came up with some normative data. So if you get a stress ultrasound on somebody and they're well under what the normal amount of gapping is, you can say, okay, this person probably doesn't have a UCL tear. But if they get into that, you know, plus minus normal range, the question becomes, is this an injury? And if you don't have pre-injury data on them, it can sometimes be difficult to interpret that. So I would say, you know, for the Phillies and things like that, we have preseason stress ultrasound data on these players. So it's really beneficial for us in that setting. But if you don't have that pre-injury data, sometimes it can be a little bit harder to interpret.
Gotcha. So you're saying for the Phillies, you guys are doing stress ultrasound exams on all the pitchers or all the players, or who are you guys doing that for? I think it's very interesting that you're able to do that. That's really novel.
Yeah, we collect a lot of information on our spring training on a lot of our pitchers. Certain guys don't do it, but the majority of our pitchers we have stress ultrasound data on. And so we can actually go back and look at some of that data, which is something we're doing now, looking at predictive factors for potential UCL tears. So more to come on that as we analyze that data a little bit further, but it's really beneficial. And I would suggest that, you know, people that take care of teams, whether it's, you know, high school, college, pro, it's an interesting data point to collect before the season starts.
Yeah. I mean, I think that'd be interesting. It's what other stuff you guys get out of that, because I think that could be really interesting. And I think your point, you know, in isolation, any kind of stress radiographs is really difficult. You know, what do you think about comparing to the contralateral side? I think sometimes we do that in the knee, but probably in the shoulder, but the elbow with, you know, throwing arm and non-throwing arm is probably quite different. Have you noticed that in your evaluations?
Yeah, it's very different. I mean, we definitely see some increased laxity in the throwing arm of pitchers. And we see some changes in the ligament from a thickening perspective as their workload goes up. Some of Pete Chalmers' work touched on that. So while we definitely can use that from a, you know, KT-1000 and things like that in the knee from an elbow perspective, I don't think it's super relevant.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. So I think the other really interesting part that came out of the diagnosis here, the one that had the least consensus was MRI or MRA. And, you know, it's interesting. Obviously, if you do an MRA, you have to time it with the anesthesiologist. It may take a little bit longer to get because you have to have, you know, be doing working hours and have to have fluoro to get that injection in there. So, you know, I know it kind of depends, but how are you deciding between getting the MRI or getting the MRA, or is there certain times when you're deciding, okay, an MRI is good enough, or how are you deciding?
So I'll tell you, I did my fellowship at HSS and I spent a lot of time with Dr. Potter learning how to read elbow MRIs. And so just in case she listens to this, I will tell you, I do not get MR arthrograms on anybody.
That's good.
No, but the reality is, you know, you have to shut those guys down for a little bit with an arthrogram. I think if you have a good scanner, certainly a 3T is great, but if you have a 1.5T where they do a good job and get the cuts in the correct plane, I think you can usually see what you need to see with an MRI. So I actually do not routinely get MRAs. I have patients that come in from other places with MRAs that obviously we read. But if the dye is not put in the right spot, you can sometimes get some edema around the flexor pronator that may look like an injury if dye leaks out or they didn't get in the right spot. You can think that something else is going on that may not be. So I personally don't get MR arthrograms, but I don't think you're wrong to get it. I don't personally do it though.
Okay. That's good to know. Yeah. I think especially if now 3T scans are becoming more and more commonplace, I think that those are probably pretty good, I would imagine. So
yeah.
And then this wasn't as one of the consensus questions, but you talk about in your discussion a little bit was the risk factors. And you talk about total arc of motion versus just GERD itself. Obviously, we've all in residency learned about GERD and the risk factors for shoulder and elbow injuries. But kind of get your take on this evolution, maybe not just internal rotation, but total arc of motion and kind of your thoughts on that.
Yeah, that was a really good thing you picked up on. And Kevin Wilk, to his credit, I mean, is absolutely outstanding as a therapist and a huge source of knowledge for me. And he did some really great work a couple of years back looking at total shoulder arc of motion for risk of elbow as well as shoulder injuries in a lot of professional players over the course of a few seasons. And what he actually found was that total arc of motion was a much more significant risk factor for sustaining shoulder and elbow injuries. And actually, if you're looking at arc of motion in general, if you break it down between internal and external, a bigger risk factor was actually not gaining enough external rotation. So if you compare the two shoulders side to side, throwing and non-throwing, you want to see at least a 5-degree gain of external rotation in your throwing shoulder. If you don't have that, that's a huge risk factor. So I'll tell you, anybody that comes into my office, I mean, obviously, listen, we're trying to see a lot of patients and be very efficient in our office day. But something I do in all of my throwers is a very quick, easy exam where I have them lay on their side like I'm doing a sleeper stretch. And so their scapula is basically pinned against the bed. And I check their internal and external rotation just to get a kind of quick and dirty sense of, are they really tight or are they pretty loose? And if they're getting close to, you know, 170 degrees of total arc of motion, I think that's pretty good. If it gets to be less than that, I get a little bit worried.
Okay. That's a really good point. And very important physical exam part that you're mentioning there. So thanks for bringing that up. Move on to the next part of here is kind of the non-operative management. So touching a little bit on that with the, you know, sleeper stretching and stuff like that. And I think that, you know, general good consensus here that you guys had, but was there anything in the non-operative part that kind of stood out to you as you looked at the results?
No, I think the non-operative treatment of these is, I think, pretty straightforward in the sense that a lot of our players that have partial thickness tears, whether that's proximal or distal, we're going to try, of course, a non-operative treatment with a couple of the guys from Cleveland Clinic that tears. So we have that conversation with our players, try and extend a course of non-operative treatment or not to treat these players conservatively. But a lot of my practice is high school and college age players. And so unless they have an acute full thickness tear or an acute, very high grade partial tear, most of my players are getting a course of conservative treatment.
Conservatives, they're talking about like, you know, if they just have no discrete tear, but like some soreness and pain over there, getting them to stretching, looking at the pitching mechanics, is that kind of the pathway you're using normally?
Yeah, so I usually use a 4 to 6 week time of frame of shutting them down, not having them throw at all. We start physical therapy. We work on total arc of motion, the shoulder, like we talked about, scapular mechanics, scapular control. And then I also have them focus on contralateral hip range of motion. So landing leg hip range of motion, because we've done some work looking at risk factors for, you know, shoulder and elbow injuries. And we know that if you can't properly internally rotate over your landing leg, that puts you at risk for injury because it puts more stress up the kinetic chain. And there's a good study out of Japan that looked at that. So I kind of harp on shoulder motion on the throwing side and hip motion on their non-throwing side. And we'll see if their exam is back to normal. So if they don't have pain with the moving valgus stress test or a milking maneuver, their elbows quieted down and they feel pretty good, I'll let them start a return to throwing program. And if they're still positive on their exam, then either we'll give it a little bit more time or we'll have them throw, but we have a real conversation with them, you know, saying, listen, if your exam is still positive, the chance that you're going to be able to successfully throw is much less, much lower.
Okay. So if I get this right, you're saying, so people who come in with a tear, you're going to try these non-operative measures that you just discussed, or these people who come in, maybe not a frank tear, but some, you know, some increased signal and some soreness in, there, or are these also for the people with the full tears?
Well, a lot of times these are people that will come in with kind of elbow symptoms that are consistent with the tear. And then we don't necessarily just jump to some advanced imaging right away, especially if they're a high school athlete. Try not to push the MRI on them too quickly, because chances are I would treat them conservatively anyway. So I'd usually start with this. And then if these things didn't work, then I would wind up getting the MRI. Sometimes they come in with the MRI, but if they haven't already come in with it, then I'll usually start slow.
Gotcha. Okay. And then another question that came up and was as one of the questions too, is the role of biologics or PRP. And you had a really good discussion about that. And you know, just see if you can expand on that, the role of PRP and when you use it in these elbow injuries.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You know, we had a lot of discussion back and forth about the biologics as far as non-operative treatment goes. And I would tell you, if you synthesize all the data that's out there, we did a study looking in the Major League Baseball hits database and saw that it didn't necessarily make a difference in an ability of guys to get back to return to play. And if you look at some of the case series that are out there, Podesta, Dines, et cetera, they do show a good return to play rate with the PRP injection. The downside to the study that we did in the HITS database was we didn't have access to the number of PRP injections they had all the time or the makeup of the PRP injections, whether leukocyte rich or leukocyte poor. So that was definitely a weakness in our study. And then if you look at some of the case series, obviously you're just having a case series of people that had UCL tears and had PRP. So you don't have a control group to see if they would have gotten better without the PRP anyway. So I think the data that's out there is kind of plus minus. So I think there isn't anything wrong with doing PRP for these patients. I don't necessarily push it on my high school and college age players. Certainly some people come in asking for it, and I'm always happy to, you know, get them set up for it. I don't do them myself. I'll have them see one of my partners to do it under ultrasound guidance. I don't think it's wrong to do it. I just can't tell you with 100% certainty that if you get a PRP injection for this, it's going to make a difference.
Right. Yeah. I'd say that we kind of see the same thing here at Duke. You know, patients and a lot of our collegiate players that come in and asking for PRP when they have some elbow pain and stuff. And it's always hard to have to answer that. But you're right. I mean, I don't do them myself either, and have my partners do them. And there's a period of shutting them down after the PRP. So maybe that helps. But I think there's still, like you said, a lot to learn about the role of PRP and the concoction that you're going to use. So
yeah, I think you're right. The shutdown period is exactly part of it, right? So you're doing the non-operative treatment anyway. So it's hard to parse out, you know, how much the PRP plays a role unless you kind of MRI them, you know, pre and post and things like that, and do a really good controlled study on it.
Right. Right. Well, I want to move on to the third kind of category you guys had was the operative management, which I thought was really interesting. It seems like there's overall pretty strong consensus on most things. But I just want to get your sense after reviewing the questions and with the group, kind of anything that stood out to you.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think the stuff you'd expect people to agree on, people agreed on. You know, who should have a UCL reconstruction? Who's a good candidate for a UCL repair? You know, Jeff Dugas put out some great work on UCL repairs. And I would tell you the majority of patients that I see are good candidates for UCL repairs at this point. The interesting part of this, and, you know, is kind of the allograft question of, you know, should we be using allograft at all, you know, in these players? And the group kind of thought, yes, in revision setting, that may be worthwhile. But again, it was a relatively low rate of agreement at 86%. You know, where I did my training at Rush, Mark Cohen does quite a few ulnar collateral ligament reconstructions. It uses a double docking technique and uses an allograft in more than 50% of his cases. And I would tell you that, you know, having spent a good amount of time with him in residency, his patients do quite well. I have not had the fortitude to use an allograft in any of the players that I've done this on yet, but I don't know that it makes a difference if we use an autograft and allograft. We pulled all of his patients when I was at Rush. We pulled all the other guys' patients, Romeo, Burma, CBJ, and we didn't see a real difference in their ability to return to sport based on graft type. So this may be something that we need to look into going forward, similar to an MPFL reconstruction using allograft versus autograft. You know, it's an extra-articular ligament. Does it make a difference if we use donor tissue or their own tissue? So, you know, there can be problems with harvesting the palmaris. We've seen case reports of median nerve harvests, or if you go to the gracilis, you know, potential hamstring issues down the road. So it's just an interesting thing to think about. I think it should generate some discussion as we learn more about it.
I would say I completely agree with you. I mean, I think that I've done a couple of these for allograft, and those patients seem to be doing very, very well. And I think there's definitely more to learn and something to think about as an option, especially those patients don't have a palmaris.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I did one yesterday, you know, and it was a younger kid and he didn't have a palmaris, and, you know, on either side. And I've learned that if they don't have a palmaris on one side, you know, usually the palmaris on the other side is not great. So I tend to not go to the other arm if they don't have an ipsilateral palmaris, because I get worried that it's not going to be a large tendon. They'll probably have a low-lying muscle belly and may not be usable. So, you know, I just did a gracilis on him, but I kind of was thinking afterwards, I'm like, gosh, this kid's pretty young. I'm taking a gracilis from his landing leg where he doesn't have any issues. And is it the right thing to do? And so I think it's the discussion point that we have to have going forward.
Yeah, I totally agree. Just to kind of, the next question was kind of like, you know, you mentioned it in one of your responses just now, and also in the survey and also in discussion, was that repairs, you know, ECL repairs are becoming much more popular. And you mentioned that even for most readers, you're seeing that people are candidates for UCL repairs. And, you know, how do you think that evolution has come? I know Jeff Duke has done a lot of work showing that, but how is that, how did you evolve in that? Did you do a lot of that in fellowship, or is that something you've kind of learned in practice here?
Yeah, I didn't do many in fellowship at all. It had just kind of started to get popular when I was finishing up my fellowship. So it was not something I did in fellowship. And then, you know, learning from Jeff and talking to Jeff about this a lot and getting his tips and tricks on it. You know, when I started, I saw a lot of patients that I thought, based on his data, were really good candidates for a repair, you know, full thickness or high grade partial thickness, proximal or distal tear with an otherwise healthy ligament. And I said, listen, I'm going to start to adopt this and see how it goes. And I'll tell you, I have had, you know, knock on wood, a very good success with the repair. Now, listen, if somebody's tissue deficient, like the kid I was telling you about yesterday, I don't think a repair in isolation is the best option at this point. I think we still have more to learn about it. A repair is a very viable ligament. Major league guys that maybe have some more miles on their elbow, and they have a, you know, a ligament that's been beaten up, or they have a large osteophyte within it. By the time you shell that out, you wind up with a ligament that's not totally healthy. You know, those are not the ones that you want to really repair. But in the ones who have good quality tissue, I think a repair is a great surgery. You just have to make sure you get the tape isometric.
Gotcha. Yep. I think that's definitely key. And so you're saying you're seeing a lot of proximal or distal avulsions more, or are you doing this for mid-substance tears as well?
No, I haven't done the mid-substance one yet. I know Jeff has done a couple and he's been pretty happy with it. George Paletta has also done quite a few of these and he has great results with them as well. So I don't honestly see a lot of mid-substance tears. Most of mine are proximal or distal, but when I do have the mid-substance or I am tissue deficient, you know, I've actually moved away from a standard reconstruction. I've started to move more towards a hybrid technique. So Tony Romeo had a great idea of adding in an internal brace with a graft. And so what I've migrated to, and what I think a lot of surgeons are doing some form of, although the techniques probably differ a little bit, is doing a graft, but also adding in an internal brace and repairing the native ligament. So I think that's probably the way things are going to move. And I think the rehabilitation process will speed up a little bit as we do this, rather than it being the 12 to 18 month return from a full reconstruction. I think it'll get kind of in that 9 to 10 month range. So a little bit longer than a repair, but not quite as long as we've seen with a full-fledged reconstruction.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, there's been so much of evolution since the first Tommy John, obviously. And another thing that came up, you know, I was thinking about as we were looking at this was kind of the approach to it too. So muscle split versus elevation. It looks like that both of them were listed. It was consensus that one of the two, but I want to get your thoughts on which one you like to do and what the discussion points we should be thinking about with one or the other.
Yeah, I think that as long as you do your approach well, you can do whichever of those two approaches you like. I personally do a muscle split. It's how I was trained and it's how I've been comfortable doing it for the last 5 or 6 years. But I would tell you that if you do an elevation and you do the ASMI technique and you transpose the nerve every time, there's nothing wrong with that as long as you do it the right way. So I think part of the stuff you saw on the paper was, you know, if you have a technique that's reliable for you, do it that way. So if you're an elevation person, then do that. If you're a muscle split person, do that. I tend to do a muscle split. And usually there's a nice kind of thick white raphe that you just can split right down and you can spread down to the ligament. You don't really have to cut much. You just kind of spread with a couple of elevators. And it gets you right down to where you need to be most of the time. So for me, that's been really reliable, but I don't think you're wrong to do to elevate.
Yeah, you can definitely find people who do either ones and feel very passionate about the others. But I think your point is good. Like whatever technique you do and you do it well, I think either one would be good. So
do you split or do you elevate, Brent?
I split.
Yeah.
So I just split. But, so just move on to the last one here for the rehab and return to sport. Anything that kind of stood out to you in terms of rehab? I mean, I think in listening to discussion, and I agree with this, there's still a lot to learn about how we should do the return to sport. But was there anything kind of that stood out to you?
Yeah, there is a lot to learn. And I would tell you, we picked the people that we thought were the absolute experts in this. I mean, Kevin Wilk, Mike Reinhold, Stan Conti. I mean, just everybody who rehabs a ton of these to get their opinion on. And, you know, you can see that, again, there was a lot of, you know, places where we had some pretty strong consensus and a couple of places where we didn't have great great consensus. And a lot of the places where our consensus wasn't great was in the timing of when we should allow people to throw and get back to sport. Because I think the bottom line is we don't know. There are some guys that progress a little bit faster than others. And trying to put an absolute time frame on this is probably not the right answer. Now, there's other factors that go into this, obviously. You know, how much work do you have to do on their kinetic chain? Are you changing their arm slot? You know, how's their velocity progressing? Do they have anything else done? Do they have an osteophyte that was taken down or another nerve transposition at the same time? And so I think that's what we have to figure out going forward. And there's probably some part of this that has to be individualized to each person. So, you know, when let's say I do a UCL repair and I tell them before surgery, you know, in about 6 to 7 months, I'd expect you to be very close to, if not thrown off a mound in game competition. And there are some people who at, you know, 4.5, 5 months feel like they're ready. And there are some people who take, you know, 8 to 9 months. And I don't think there's a right or wrong answer. I think we just have to listen to that person's elbow as they go through the rehabilitation process and see where they're at.
Yeah, I agree. It's so hard to know in the time frames. You know, everyone's always asked that, like how many months, how long away. And it's so hard to say within the exact science to that because we just don't know. So I think your point taken, it's individualized kind of approach to it. I thought one thing that's definitely in the return to sport literature that's gaining a lot of traction, not just in elbows, but throughout sports medicine is, you know, the psychological aspect of it. What are your thoughts on that with UCL?
Yeah, I think that's a great point and something we don't talk enough about. You know, I'll tell you, I had a pretty good size injury to my ankle when I was in college. I had an open fracture dislocation in my ankle. So I had that treated relatively quickly. And then, you know, it took me a while when I was, you know, back to full speed and everything to be able to run across the middle of the football field and not think that I was going to get lit up and have my ankle broken again. And so I empathize with these guys that have a traumatic injury. You know, how bad the trauma was, you can debate, but it's a traumatic injury. And for them to trust their body to go back to do that again can take some time. And we see, you know, if you look at the return to sport, not so much for UCLs, but other things, ACLs, things like that. A lot of times the second season, somebody's back, they do a little bit better. So from a UCL perspective, I think that's something we need to consider. Now, the question is, how do you measure somebody's readiness or mental toughness to get back to going, or, you know, their grit, as Dr. Bach liked to say. And I think we still have to learn how to do that. But I think you're exactly right that there should be some kind of measurable effect of us to do that, to let these guys go back.
Yeah. So I agree too. I mean, I think it's something we just don't know as much about and to study more. But so kind of the last question I have about, you know, what's the future? What do you think the future will say 5-10 years from now in UCLs? If there's like two things you can put into your crystal ball and say, this is what we should be looking at or thinking about, whether that's return to play or surgery techniques, what do you think it is?
Yeah, I think so. For me, it's I think we're going to see a much higher growth of UCL repairs. And I think as long as we continue to do them in the right person, I think we'll see really good results with that. I think there are indications from that will probably expand a little bit, and I'm anxious to see how the results go from that. The questions I'd like to see answered that I don't think we have the answer to yet are exactly what you said, and it involves return to sport. Can we get these guys back faster, or do we really need to wait as long as we need to in that 12 to 18 month mark for reconstructions? And I think some of that will parse itself out as we get into doing more of the hybrid techniques and seeing how long it takes those guys to get back. Because if the hybrid technique works well, and whatever hybrid technique you're using, if that works well and it does what we think it can do with the internal brace backing it up, I do think we can accelerate these players getting back. But I will say, you know, having, you know, seen a lot of these and rehab through some of them and dealt with players at different levels, if you rush guys back too fast from this, they don't tend to do well. So if you're erring on the side of being a little slower, a little faster, my personal opinion is to be a little slower. Players don't always love that. Teams don't always love that. But you're looking for the best long-term health of the player. And so if it takes a little while longer to get them back, I think you go with that.
Yeah, I agree. So. Exciting stuff. And this is a great paper. I think it goes over a lot of the questions that a lot of us have who do these type of surgeries. And I think it's a must read for everyone. So again, I just want to thank Dr. Brandon Erickson for taking the time, but also his co-authors, Owen Hurley, Edwards Mochika, and Dr. Jaswari from and the rest of the ulnar collateral ligament consensus group. This is going to be in arthroscopy. Thanks so much for taking the time for joining us. It was a lot of fun, learned a lot, and I look forward to doing more of these with you, hopefully.
Yeah, Brian, that was awesome. I really appreciate you having me on. I the discussion's awesome. I you know, I'm really excited to hear what people think about this. And if they do things differently, you know, please feel free to drop us some comments or you know, email us or text or whatever. I'm, you know, this was 26 people that do these a lot, but there's a lot of people around the country that also do these. So we'd love to hear their thoughts.
Perfect. So thanks so much.
The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent the views of the Arthroscopy Association or the Arthroscopy Journal. This concludes this edition of the Arthroscopy Podcast.